nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so now we're starting a different topic in this course. We're moving from low field transport. We have to figure out how to handle high field transport and then off equilibrium transport. And the first step in this is to try to understand in a little more detail scattering, because we have to know more about it than there is this mean free path. Where does the mean free path come from? So we're familiar with the Boltzmann equation. We can solve this near equilibrium, but we can also solve it with high fields and short devices and near ballistic. We could solve it in much more general conditions than we've solved it so far. But we have to learn much more about scattering and how to treat it. So we have this collision integral, and this is what makes the Boltzmann equation complicated. We've been approximating this by a relaxation time approximation, which makes things simple enough that we can work out answers analytically. But we want to talk about this a little more. So first of all, this transition probability, S of P, P prime, where does this come from? How do you get this? This is related somehow to the microscopic scattering processes. So if we know that electrons are scattering off of phonons, we ought to be able to calculate this. If we know there are charged impurities, we ought to be able to calculate this. So for the next 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to talk about, one of the things that we will talk about is how we calculate that transition rate, the probability per second that an electron will scatter from a state P to a state P prime, some other state. Okay, then once you have that, it's a little hard to interpret and figure out what it means, because it's a microscopic quantity. It's a transition between one microscopic K state and another. And we usually have more of a physical feel for more macroscopic quantities. So we want to understand how we extract from that some times that have some physical meaning to us that we can make sense of. And that's mainly what I'm going to be talking about today, these characteristic times. So only two topics. It'll be a short lecture. So think about doing a Gedanken experiment like this. We're able to inject a bunch of electrons into a semiconductor, and we've aligned all of their momentum in one direction. So at time t equals zero, we inject them in. Maybe they're energetic. You know, they're not at thermal equilibrium. We inject a stream of electrons, all with the momentum aligned along one coordinate axis, and we ask what happens. Right? So you wait. If you wait a time tau, which is the average time between collisions or scattering events, then on average, everyone will have scattered once. Some will have scattered more, some won't have scattered yet, but on average, everyone will have encountered one scattering event. Okay. But you can see that that might not be enough time to randomize the momentum. Depending on the particular scattering process, I may still have a net momentum in one direction. I might not have completely randomized the momentum yet. And if these are energetic carriers, then the length of this momentum vector is much bigger than it was than it would be in equilibrium. And they're still very energetic. Even though they've scattered, they're still not in equilibrium. Well, if I wait a little bit longer, tau sub m, so tau sub m is called the momentum relaxation time. Now all of the momentum has been randomized. So instead of having a net momentum along one direction, we now have the average momentum is zero. We've destroyed all of the initial momentum. Now, depending on the particular scattering process, that might take longer than the scattering time, because some scattering processes prefer to deflect electrons just by a small angle. And then it takes many of those in order to turn them around and randomize the momentum. So in general, the momentum relaxation time is longer than the scattering time. Sometimes they're equal. And then finally, if I wait long enough, they'll dissipate all of their energy to the lattice. And they'll usually have to shed optical phonons or some kind of phonons to get rid of the energy. And now the length of each arrow is smaller. So the average momentum is still zero. But the length, the magnitude of the momentum, is now an equilibrium distribution. That's called the energy relaxation time. And that's generally longer than the momentum relaxation time, which is generally equal to or greater than the scattering time. All right, any questions on those? So these are times that make some physical sense. You know, we'd like to learn how to compute these times because it gives us a feeling as to what goes on. And they must all be related to this transition rate. So we have this transition rate that tells us the probability per second for scattering from some initial state. I'm going to call it P0 now, but later on we'll just drop the P0, the zero. But the idea is we have electrons coming in with some specific momentum. What's the probability per unit second that it will scatter to some other momentum, any other momentum? Okay. Now, if I want to know the probability that it will scatter anywhere, not just to a particular P prime, but to anywhere, what's the probability per second that it will scatter anywhere, I'll do a sum. So I'll sum over all of the states P prime that it might scatter to, and I will sum all of these probabilities that this initial electron in P0 can scatter to another state P prime. I'll sum over all of the other states that it might scatter to. And presumably I know how to compute the probability for each one of those states. So I'll just add them all up. Now, I should be careful because some of those states might be full. They might already have electrons in, and I can't scatter into a full state, right? The Pauli principle, exclusion principle. And I'm drawing an arrow up, which I may drop later on just because it gets cumbersome. And that's to help me remember that most of the scattering processes that we talk about, all of them that we talk about in this class, don't affect the spin of an electron. You know, there are magnetic impurities, and when people are working on spintronic devices, they worry about spin-flip scattering. But for the common scattering processes, ionized impurity scattering, phonon scattering, if an electron comes in with spin up, it scatters only to a spin up P prime. It can't scatter to a spin down P prime because the scattering mechanisms can't flip the spin. If it comes in with a spin down, it can only scatter into the spin down. So when I do this sum, I have to remember not to multiply by 2 because it can only scatter into the spin states that are aligned with its initial spin. All right, so we're just assuming no spin flip scattering. You could work it out if there were spin flip scattering, and people do that. Now, it's hard to compute this quantity because in order to compute this quantity here, I have to know what F of P prime is. It means I already have to have solved the Boltzmann equation to figure out how many of those other states are full. So in general, that's a difficult thing to do. We're trying to talk about putting scattering in the Boltzmann equation so that we can solve it. So people will usually compute an outscattering rate. We'll assume that the other states are empty and we can scatter into them. If the scattering potential knocks me to some P prime, I'm just going to assume that that P prime is empty and I can always scatter into it. So the physical picture is we're injecting a stream of electrons in a semiconductor that doesn't have any electronic states occupied yet, and we're just asking where do they scatter out to. And this characteristic time, people usually call it the scattering rate. So I'm going to call it the outscattering rate, it doesn't have this blocking factor in it. Now, when people do numerical calculations and solve the Boltzmann equation, they'll usually iteratively figure this out. You know, you might be doing a Monte Carlo simulation and you'll have a scattering event that wants to send you to another state. Then you'll check and see what's my current estimate of F of P prime at that state. And if it's 70%, you'll choose random numbers such that 70% of the time you're able to go in and the other times you can't. And there'll be numerical schemes that you'll used to treat effects like that. But in order to actually calculate these scattering rates, it'll be the outscattering rate that we can calculate. So the physical picture, when we get down to doing these calculations, we have a momentum coming in, P0. And there is a coordinate system, you know, for the device or whatever the structure is. There are X, Y, and Z axes. But it really doesn't matter if this band structure is isotropic. It's most convenient while I'm doing calculating this outscattering rate to align the Z axis with the incoming electron. Right? So when I do this calculation, that may not be my coordinate Z axis. I might have to do a transformation later, but I'll align the Z axis with the incoming. It'll scatter to some other state P prime. I'll call the polar angle alpha. I won't call it theta because that might be the coordinate system in the laboratory, but it's, and I'll do my calculation that way. So you'll see that when we actually work these out. We'll align the coordinate axes with the incident momentum, and then we'll calculate the outscattering rate. So we'll end up doing something like this. When we convert the sum to an integral, it'll be volume in 3D. It'll be volume over 2 pi squared. We won't multiply by 2 because there's no spin flip scattering. We'll integrate over the azimuthal angle. We'll integrate over the polar angle. And we'll integrate over the magnitude of P, which might change if we have inelastic scattering processes. Okay. All right, so how do we get, so that's one of the scattering times, that people, what people would call the scattering rate. That we can compute. How about this momentum relaxation time? How would we compute the momentum relaxation time? Remember, we're assuming that we can figure out how to compute S of P, P naught, P prime. We're going to talk about that in another lecture or two. That's where Fermi's golden rule in quantum mechanics comes in. So let's assume that that transition rate is known. If I weight each one of those transitions by the fractional change in momentum, then I'll have what people call the momentum relaxation rate. And see, it's a rate, so it's 1 over time. Now, that makes physical sense. You know, if I have a very small deflection, I have almost no change in momentum. So the fractional change in momentum is almost 0. So that scattering event had almost no effect on the momentum. So you just weight each transition by the fractional change in momentum. And then we just have a different sum. So that fractional change, it's going to be the momentum. I always have to think about a momentum relaxation rate in some direction. So I've aligned all of these electrons. They're coming in along the z-axis. The initial momentum is pz0, because p0 is the initial momentum. It scatters to a different state that has a different z component, pz prime. And then I divide by the initial z-directed momentum to get a fractional. So it's 1 minus pz prime over p0. And since our geometry looks like this, we can write the momentum relaxation rate as this sum, S of P naught, P prime, weighted by the fractional change in momentum, which is 1 minus magnitude of the scattered electron state over magnitude of the incident electron state times cosine of the polar angle between the two. Okay. So later on, when we actually work these out, this is the sum that we're going to have to work out. Now, what's the connection between these two scattering times? We have two times now. We have this time to scatter, tau, and we have the time to relax momentum, tau sub m. What's the relation between those two? So tau sub m, we've just discussed what its definition is. So there are two terms there. There's a 1 minus something. So I can break it out into separate two terms. The first term there I'm going to recognize. That's what I've already called the scattering rate. So it's 1, the momentum relaxation rate is the scattering rate minus something. It's going to be smaller than the scattering rate if the particular scattering processes aren't very effective in relaxing momentum. And that's what the second term is going to do. It's going to reduce the momentum relaxation rate, make it smaller than the scattering rate. unless S of P, not P, doesn't have any angular dependence. If it doesn't have any preference for deflecting it in one direction or the other, then when I do this integration over cosine alpha, when I integrate from 0 to 2 pi, I'll get a 0. So the last term won't give me any contribution. As long as the scattering is isotropic, when the scattering has no preference to send me one direction to another or another, the last term integrates to 0, and the momentum relaxation time is equal to the scattering time. Which is why in that first little picture I said tau m is greater than or equal to tau. If it's isotropic scattering, the two are equal. If it's anisotropic, tau m can be much longer. Yes.
In definition, the momentum relaxation time, after that, the average momentum should be 0, right, for this electron, wherever it's coming.
Pardon me? After that what?
After the momentum relaxation time, mm-hmm. the average momentum of the electron should be 0.
Yeah, so we'll have to do an ensemble average here to do, yes.
Mm-hmm. How this fact is embedded in this definition?
Pardon me?
How this fact is embedded in this equation?
Yeah, how does that, so you're asking how does the average z-directed momentum of this ensemble vary with time? Right. Yeah. I mean, what I've given you here is a very plausible definition, right? It's scattering time times a fractional change in momentum. It tells me how rapidly you're losing momentum. Now you're asking if I have a z-directed momentum at time t equals 0, how does it vary with time? Could probably set up a differential equation. It wouldn't be 0 after a momentum relaxation time. Right. You know, my guess is it's going to decay as e to the minus t over momentum relaxation time. The momentum relaxation time will give us the 1 over e point. And if you wait long enough, it'll exponentially decay to 0.
Yeah.
No, if we... So that's a good... You know, maybe we'll talk about it when we have a discussion. If we were actually to find out how the ensemble average momentum varies with time, you'd expect it to go as e to the minus t over tau. Same thing with the energy. You'd expect the energy to relax as e to the minus t over energy relaxation time. Okay. Energy relaxation time. So again, it's the same kind of thing. We have a scattering event. The scattering events may not change the energy. If the scattering is elastic, if it scatters off an ionized impurity, there's no change in energy. If it scatters off a phonon, you can change the energy by a phonon energy, which tends to be relatively small. So if the electron comes in with a lot of energy, if it's elastic scattering, delta E will be 0. If it's phonon scattering, each scattering event might take away just a little bit of its energy. So we just wait by the fractional change in energy for each scattering event. That's just the energy it came in with minus the energy it went out with, that's how much energy we lost, divided by the energy that we came in with. So if it's elastic scattering, there's no energy relaxation. If it's phonon scattering, the energy can change by h bar omega. Okay. So if you have a situation where you have a lot of ionized impurities and almost all of your scattering is elastic, and you compute the energy relaxation rate, it'll be 0, or the energy relaxation time will be infinite. You'll never relax the energy if you don't have phonon scattering. If you have a set of energetic electrons, they're mainly going to scatter by emitting phonons. They'll do that much more, they'll be much more likely to do that than absorbing phonons. So if it comes in, let's say it comes in with 3/10 of an EV of kinetic energy. You can do that with heterojunctions. An optical phonon energy is roughly how much? Right. Order of magnitude. Factor of 2. Anybody know how much H bar omega would be for an optical phonon? One EV? Bigger or smaller? All right, somebody has to guess. What's your guess, Dionysus? That's not a bad guess. Yeah, there are some of these numbers, you know, we want to be calibrated on, and we want to have some feeling for what they are. It's frequently about 30, 40, 50, 60. Yeah. So you order of magnitude right. So let's say it's 30 millielectron volts, typical optical phonon energy. We inject electrons with 3/10 of an EV. We can easily accelerate them to that kind of energy with an electric field or with produce a heterojunction. So this ratio here is 1/10. It means it would take 10 emissions of optical phonons to remove that 3/10 of energy that they had to begin with. That means that the energy relaxation time would be 10 times the scattering time. That's why energy relaxation times are typically much longer than scattering times. It takes longer to dissipate the energy. So when we look at this, it's important when we start talking, when we talk later on in the course about what happens in devices, it'll be important to have this sense as to how these times compare. We have a scattering rate. We have a momentum scattering rate, momentum relaxation rate, which sometimes are the same. And depending on the particular scattering processes, the momentum relaxation rate could be significantly longer. And then we have an energy relaxation time, which is generally much longer than either the momentum relaxation rate or the scattering rate. Yeah.
Can you relate the energy relaxation time to the momentum relaxation time being fractional?
Well, the same idea is there that we're waiting, you know, if we're interested in momentum relaxation rate, we wait by the fractional change in momentum. If we're interested in the energy relaxation rate, we relax by the fractional change in energy. What if we have anything else? That was a nice timing on the question. You might want a relaxation rate for something else. So if I have something else that's some function of momentum, phi. Energy is a function of momentum, right? Momentum is a function of momentum. Almost any physical quantity that I look at could be a function of momentum. I would just, if I wanted the relaxation rate associated with that quantity, I would just multiply the scattering rate by the fractional change in that quantity. Same kind of idea. So for example, you might want to know, what's the velocity relaxation rate? It isn't quite the same as the momentum relaxation rate. All right. In a simple band, you know, velocity is h bar k over m, but in more complicated bands, the relationship between the two isn't quite as simple. That's okay. I have a quantity now that's a function of momentum. I can find the z-directed velocity by taking the slope of the energy band at that state. And I can compute this sum that just represents the fractional change in velocity. I could get a velocity relaxation rate. So there are lots of other ones I could compute if I need them for a problem. I could find a relaxation rate for any physical quantity.
Why do we find everything with respect to momentum?
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time.
Why do we find everything with respect to momentum?
Oh, because why is everything defined with respect to momentum? Or why am I defining phi as a function of momentum? Because that's a good question, too. Yeah. Remember when we derived the Boltzmann equation and we talked about this scattering processes? The Boltzmann equation was an equation that tracked a particle in momentum and position space. And it followed some trajectory that just followed these semi-classical equations of motion. And every now and then, there was a scattering process. And our assumption is that the scattering is occurring by very short-range quantum mechanical potentials, and it occurs very quickly. And what it does is it doesn't change the position. It just knocks an electron to a different momentum, and then things start on their way again. So when I'm talking about scattering, I'm at some fixed position, and I'm just talking about what's happening in momentum space, going from one p-naught to another p-naught. And that's why, you know, I'm only asking what are the quantities that are changing in momentum space there. That's why. And you can see, we've looked at quantities, energy, momentum, velocity. Every one is just some function of p. Yeah. All right. So let's tie up a loose end here. You know, we had this relaxation time approximation. And we started with the collision integral. And the 1 minus f factors make things really complicated. So we assumed that we had Boltzmann statistics. And we asked ourselves, could we simplify this? And the relaxation time approximation says that this very complicated scattering collision integral can be approximated by minus f symmetric divided by some characteristic time. But we really didn't say what characteristic time it is. Okay, now we've introduced some characteristic times. The question is, what is this tau sub f? How do we calculate it? We really need to know how to do that. So there are really actually two questions. One is, when can we use this? When is it a good approximation? And if we can use it, how is this quantity tau f? Is it the scattering time? Is it the momentum relaxation time? Is it the energy relaxation time? What the heck is it? All right, so if we start it with this simplified collision integral and work on it a little bit, I can simplify it even more. First of all, I simplified it by assuming Boltzmann statistics. Okay, then I can simplify it by assuming I'll show you how we simplify it. We're going to be near equilibrium. We have a large symmetric component that looks just like the equilibrium component. That's F naught. Plus, we have a small anti-symmetric component that carries all the current. When we solve the Boltzmann equation in the RTA, that's what we solve for. So I can write F prime as F naught of P prime plus F anti-symmetric of P prime and do the same thing for F of P. Okay. But I also know that in equilibrium, when F is F naught, the collision integral has to be zero. So two terms in this sum, the ones involving F naught, sum to zero, because they look just like the equilibrium. We know what their sum is in equilibrium, and we're having the equilibrium one. So our simplified collision integral really only involves the anti-symmetric components. So we simplified the first line by replacing F by F anti-symmetric. Now there's a further simplification that we can do. So if I look at this collision integral again, I have two different quantities. I have an S of P prime P and an S of P to P prime. So I have a probability to go from P to P prime, and then I have a probability to go from P prime back to P. In general, those are different. It would be nice if I could just simplify things by dealing with one of them. And there's a way that we can do that. So again, we're going to go back to equilibrium. And in equilibrium, we know that that collision integral is zero. But we know even more in equilibrium. We know that every term in the sum is zero, because that's what detailed balance says. Okay. So this allows me to relate the two in equilibrium. So I can solve for S of P prime P. That's S of P, P prime, times F naught of P divided by F naught of P prime. So that allows me to eliminate one in terms of the other in equilibrium. Okay. But now I'm going to argue that I can use this out of equilibrium too. Because S of P, P prime, these are just microscopic transition rates. They're just transitions from one K state to another depending on some microscopic scattering potential. You know, in those transitions, the electrons don't know what the ensemble is doing. They don't know if they're in equilibrium or not. They don't know if an applied bias has been applied, because the scattering potentials are so much stronger than the applied biases. When we calculate these scattering rates, we ignore them. So even though I derive this in equilibrium, I can use it out of equilibrium. So now I'll go back. I'll go back to the first simplification, where we replace the Fs by F antisymmetrics. And then we'll use the second simplification that relates one S of P prime, S of P prime P to S of PP prime. And that allows me to write my collision integral this way. Okay. So all I've done, I now have both terms in, that are S of P to P prime, but I've introduced this factor F naught of P over F naught of P prime. So my sum is always over this P primes. So I could pull an F antisymmetric of P outside the sum. And if I pull it outside the sum, and if I also pull an S of P, P prime outside, then the first term 1 and the minus sign here give me the second term in the second line. And then the first term in the second line, I've introduced a minus sign here because I'm trying to make it look like a relaxation time approximation. The second term had an S of P, P prime pulled out. It's got the ratio of Fermi functions. And now I pulled out an FA of P, so I've got to divide by an FA of P. Okay. All I've done is math. Okay. Now, if I were to say S of P, P prime, times this complicated quantity in the brackets, is 1 over the characteristic time, then it says my collision integral is minus F antisymmetric over the characteristic time. And I've proven the relaxation time approximation. I could just make this a definition. I could work out this sum no matter how complicated it is, and I would get an answer. I could always do this. Right? But it wouldn't be very useful. You know? Why is that? I could always define this to be my characteristic time, right? Compute it, and then I could write my collision integral in something that looks like a relaxation time approximation, but I would not be able to solve it. Because in general, this time depends on the unknown solution. So before I put this in the BTE and solve it, I have to know what the answer is. So it's really only going to be useful if this characteristic time doesn't depend on F. Then I can plug it into the Boltzmann equation and solve for F. That's when the relaxation time approximation is really useful. The characteristic time should be independent of F. And I've got Fs all over the place here. Right. So here's where we have to look in a little more carefully. There are a couple of conditions under which this works. One is for isotropic scattering. So if I have scattering rates that are equal in any direction, so if there's equal probability of going from P to P prime, if there's the same probability of going from P to minus P prime, if those are equal, that's isotropic scattering. Okay. Now if I look at that, well, let's see what we have in the first line. That means I'm summing over P prime. Since it's isotropic, it's the same for plus and minus P prime. It means that S of P, P prime, this transition rate, is symmetric in P prime. Okay. Now, F naught is symmetric in P prime, but FA is anti-symmetric in P prime. All right. This F of P, I'm not summing over that. I can just pull that out. This term, the second term, 1 minus the quantity that I'm subtracting, is anti-symmetric in P prime. If I multiply something that's odd in P prime times something that's even in P prime, I get something that's odd in P prime. If I sum over all the states, it integrates to zero. So in this case, all I get is minus FA out front, the sum of the transition from P to P prime. There's no F there. That's one of the reasons I assume Boltzmann statistics. I got rid of those 1 minus F terms, which would have made life really difficult. We can compute this. In fact, this is exactly what we call the scattering rate. So for isotropic scattering, the relaxation time approximation works, and the characteristic time, tau F, that we've been using before, is this outscattering rate that I talked about, something that we can compute without knowing F. All right, so we've discovered something useful. The RTA is valid, and we know how to compute the characteristic time. Oh, by the way, I'll just point out, for isotropic scattering, we mentioned earlier, the scattering rate and the momentum relaxation rate are identical for isotropic scattering. So this characteristic time is also the momentum relaxation time because the two are the same. All right, now there's another case that this works. If we do elastic scattering, if I do elastic scattering, I'm scattering from one P to another P prime, but if it's elastic, they have the same energy. If they have the same energy, then the Fermi functions at the initial state, Fermi function only depends on total energy. So then the Fermi function in the initial state and the final state are the same. So F of P over F of P prime is 1. And then I just need to work on the second term. All right. Now, I'm not going to go through that algebra. It's done in my book. It's a little more complicated than for the first case, but I'll just show you the answer. The answer turns out that for elastic scattering, that second term ends up being 1 minus cosine alpha, where alpha is the polar angle between P and P prime. Again, this is a quantity that we can compute. It's just a time, and that's my characteristic time. Now, we define the momentum relaxation time to be 1 minus magnitude of P prime over magnitude of P times cosine alpha. But it's elastic scattering. Magnitude of P prime is equal to magnitude of P. So this is the momentum relaxation rate for elastic scattering. So for elastic scattering, the relaxation time approximation is also valid. And in this case, the appropriate time is the momentum relaxation time. Okay. So this relaxation time approximation is valid near equilibrium. I should add that we've assumed Boltzmann statistics because those 1 minus F factors in the scattering in the collision integral would complicate things. So it's valid near equilibrium for Boltzmann statistics. But even then, it is only valid strictly when the scattering is either isotropic or it's elastic. Then you can use the relaxation time approximation. And when it does work, that characteristic time that we've been using is the momentum relaxation time. Right. Well, that's what it is. Now, silicon, germanium, the dominant scattering mechanisms tend to be phonon scattering, which is isotropic, ionized impurity scattering, which is elastic. So you're on safe ground. You can use the relaxation time approximation and get good results. We will see when we calculate, when we discuss scattering in 3-5 semiconductors, that the strongest scattering mechanism is polar optical phonon scattering. It's phonon scattering that involves an oscillating dipole. It is not elastic, and it is not isotropic. And that's sort of the big problem in calculating mobilities in gallium arsenide, say. Sometimes people just go ahead and use the relaxation time approximation anyway. I don't know quantitatively how good it is. You know, it's not strictly valid. If you want to see the second half of that derivation, that's done in my book. You can see how that's worked out. Okay, so this is kind of a warm-up. We're going to spend the next few weeks just getting into details about calculating S of PP prime for different scattering potentials. But the point of this lecture was to explain why it is that we're trying to calculate those quantities and what we're going to do with them after we've calculated them. Now, Friday's lecture is also a little bit of a warm-up. We won't dive into calculating transition rates. Monday we'll dive into that. But Friday we'll talk about some other things related to scattering as well. All right, any questions before we break? Yes.
So are you assuming that the parabolic relationship?
Are we assuming parabolic bands? I don't think we've made that assumption yet anywhere. You know, we had fractional change in momentum. You don't want to do h bar k over m unless it's for parabolic bands. When we actually get down to working these things out, we'll assume parabolic bands, or we'll assume graphene, and we'll work out some scattering rates. You know, people who are more worried about band structure details have to work these things out numerically. Oh, yeah. I mean, what elastic scattering means is that you come in with some momentum P pointing in some direction. The length of this, so think about a parabolic band. The energy is P squared over 2m. So the length of this vector represents its energy. If it's elastic scattering, the energy doesn't change. But the elastic scattering can send it to any other direction. So it's pointing in a different direction now. But if it's elastic, the length is the same. So. Yes?
Why defining the relaxation time in terms of the house scattering part? Shouldn't it be typically under the wind scattering?
Yeah, so why did we only consider the outscattering part? It's because in order to consider, if I really want to know the question your colleague there answered, I inject a bunch of electrons in, I want to know what the ensemble average momentum is as a function of time. If I want the answer to that question, I have to solve the Boltzmann equation. Because in order to get the inscattering properly, I need to know how all those other states are populated. I need to know what F is for all of those other states. I can calculate the probability that an electron will come from one of those states back in, but I need to know how many of those are occupied. So the reason we're focusing on outscattering states is because those are the only quantities that we can compute before we solve the Boltzmann equation. But they also, you know, they make some physical sense. So you think about injecting a beam of electrons, and you're mostly going to outscatter for a while. So it tells you initially, gives you some sense as to how long does it take before things start beginning to settle down.